This is Berkeley Voices. I'm Anne Bryce. In 1996, the Oakland Unified School District passed a resolution that recognized Black English as a language variety, distinct from what's widely considered standard English. Justin Davidson is an associate professor and sociolinguist at UC Berkeley.
And the idea was that at that time, there were many African-American students that didn't have literacy levels in academic, effectively white English that was required of them in the school system. So they were trying to find ways to mitigate that. And one of the solutions was, which seems very sound, why are we expecting people whose home language is African-American vernacular English to be just suddenly completely fluent and or proficient in an English that's not theirs, that was not used in the home, that they were not exposed to probably until the school system. So they thought, well, one of the ways to mitigate that is, why don't we have bilingual education with effectively Black English and white English?
Oakland schools piloted a bilingual literacy program called Bridge that acknowledged that Black English is real. And teachers used it to help students connect to and learn standard English.
So effectively, by teaching students in their native variety, that helps to then acquire information, knowledge, and then jump to a different variety that society sort of prescribes that they need to have in order to be successful in the school system. And it lasted a little over a year. And it was extremely successful. Their figures of literacy rates advanced like by 300%. It was great.
But there was a general misunderstanding of the program and its intentions, and it was met by widespread criticism and ridicule. The dominant narrative that took shape was that Oakland was trying to dumb down education by accepting Black English as a legitimate language of its own, and even teaching it to its students. In reaction, California Congress passed a bill that mandated that no federal funding can be used for bilingual education programs that involve any variety of language connected to English.
So it means that a program like this will not receive any federal funding because it doesn't count as bilingual. It's just two Englishes and we won't fund that. So they lost their funding and the program stopped. And the effects of that today are that, again, you cannot get any federal funding or support of any kind if the language in question is connected to quote-unquote English.
There are between 5,000 and 7,000 different languages used today in the world, says Davidson. Linguists haven't studied or documented all of them, so they're working with a relatively small sample and tend to focus on languages that are less marginalized. So the majority of linguistic theory and linguistic research has been on English varieties.
In societies where education is a main staple and mandatory, the educational system is where we get all sorts of social information about what's intelligent, what's acceptable. And the kinds of English and other languages that we teach in the school system reflect certain Englishes, certain dialects, certain varieties of English, and denigrate others.
Everyone has linguistic bias, he says, and it's conditioned based on society and our environment. In the U.S., for example, standard academic English is a variety most represented by affluent white males from the Midwest, specifically Ohio.
And so what comes from that is that if you grow up in this country and your English is farther away from that variety, then you may encounter instances where the way you speak, is judged as less okay, less intelligent, less academically sound, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of stereotypes that are out there about, Southern English, Texas, for example, English, rural hick English, that sort of thing, that's the exact same forces at play. It's that the way that certain people produce language is inferior to others. And all of that isn't, for linguists, an actual question of inherent goodness. It's all just social dynamics. It's who's in power and who are the people that are making decisions about what sounds intelligent. A really famous example is, we know that, for example, the SATs, the vocabulary and sort of the language section of the SATs, those were developed by a group of affluent white male speakers to address college-bound students of the time. And at the time, college-bound students were just that group, affluent white males.
The SAT was first administered by the College Board to about 8,000 college applicants in 1926. In the decades that followed, the Scholastic Aptitude Test, as it was known, became required to attend most colleges in the country. And while more than 2,000 colleges across the U.S. have, in recent years, stopped requiring the SAT for college admission, including all UC schools, others have actually reinstated the SAT, including MIT, Yale, and the public university systems in Georgia and Florida.
And of course, these are exams written by and for certain groups in society. And so they don't have to make an academic leap, right? They don't have to learn a new dialect of English or a new dialect of whatever language they speak in order to do well on these exams. And so it's not surprising then that we see, for example, not just in the United States, but across all countries everywhere, racial and linguistic disparity in standardized exams. So there's all sorts of linguistic injustices pervasive to every society, to every country. And sociolinguists are working hard to try and make these issues more known, more part of public discourse, so that ideally we address these things in, at least the school system.
The California bill that cut off federal funding for bilingual education programs that involve varieties of English is still in effect today.
So, for example, if you go to court, you are not afforded an interpreter if you use Black English. It does, because it doesn't count as another language, right? It's a sociopolitical question. Linguistically, Black English and white English are not the same, in the same way that California English is not the same as Texas English, is not the same as Boston English. But the way that we recognize languages politically in this country, African-American vernacular English does not count for funding like that.
A recent consequence of this happened in the trial of George Zimmerman, who shot and killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in 2012 while Martin was visiting family in a gated community in Sanford, Florida. Zimmerman, who was in a neighborhood watch group, was found not guilty. His lawyers argued that he was acting in self-defense.
And there was a witness, Rachel Jontel. So she was a witness to Trayvon Martin's death. And her English is not white academic English. It's African-American vernacular English. And so there were no interpreters involved in that court case. So the jury heard her testimony and the case proceeded.
Jontel, who was on the phone with Martin moments before he was killed, testified before the jury for nearly 6 hours. But her testimony wasn't brought up a single time during the jurors' some 16 hours of deliberation. After the trial, jurors gave interviews on national news programs. And later, linguists from Stanford University gathered these interviews, reread transcripts, and reviewed other investigators' interviews with jurors to see if the jurors understood Jontel's words.
And they didn't. There was a language barrier. And so the jury didn't understand what she was saying, and she was written off as this, uneducated, unintelligible, non-reliable witness. And it's literally a question of language discrimination. If Rachel spoke German, there would have been a translator obligatorily afforded so that the jury could understand them, but not for English and English varieties. So that's a very recent and impactful case where our understanding of what counts as language really matters.
Most people in the world, Davidson says, don't have any exposure to thinking about language in this way. By understanding and ideally appreciating linguistic diversity, he says, we can begin to contextualize our own reactions toward language varieties that don't align with standard academic English. It's the first step, he says, toward lessening the negative effects of linguistic bias on society. I'm Anne Bryce, and this is Berkeley Voices. This is the second episode of a three-part series with Davidson about language in the United States. In the first episode, he talked about how the U.S. is a Spanish-speaking country and how we as a nation need to embrace that. And in the final episode, he'll explain what happens in the brain when people speak multiple languages.
So the brain is very sort of geographically organized according to the languages that we're exposed to as children. It's fascinating.
Berkeley Voices is a Berkeley News podcast from the Office of Communications and Public Affairs at UC Berkeley. If you like what we do, please tell a friend and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We also have another show, Berkeley Talks, that features lectures and conversations at Berkeley. You can find all of our podcast episodes with transcripts and photos on Berkeley News at news.berkeley.edu/podcasts.